pussy sweeter than McCready when I meet her in the morning.
The morning
with the morning glory.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, I'm Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you will hear reminiscences of life around North Carolina's Triangle area in earlier times, written by local authors. On today's program, I'll continue reading from Wish You Were Here, a collection of essays from the editor of Our State magazine, by Elizabeth Hudson. History Among Us. My parents have collected antiques for as long as I can remember. Growing up, our house was filled with interesting objects, metal scales and vintage thermometers, pewter tavern plates with thick silversmith marks etched into the bottom, blue spongeware pitchers. As a kid, though, I had no use for these old things. Then, one day, I began to collect community cookbooks. The older, the better. I liked the recipes, of course, but more than that, I liked how you could read a town, how you could tell the story of a place, based on the recipes in the books. One of my favorites, the Pennsylvania State Grange Cookbook, circa 1940, uses ingredients my southern kitchen has never seen. Huckleberry pudding? And a closer reading of Favorite Recipes of the Carolinas, Meats, published about 45 years ago, gives a glimpse of what people were cooking in, say, Sophia. I may not ever make Mrs. Marvin Staley's quail pie, but I love knowing that she did. I can read cookbooks like these and see a kitchen just as it was many years ago, before chickens became boneless and skinless. My old cookbooks all have home remedy sections, too, because kitchens then were like apothecaries. And the books are practical. I've learned how to set a complicated table from the diagrams in these old books. By now, I probably have enough in my collection, and yet I keep thinking I'll look for just one more. I find some of the best ones at the Liberty Antiques Festival each year. On the first weekend in autumn, and again in the spring, 100 acres of farmland off U.S. Highway 421 transform into a setting for one of the largest antiques festivals in the state. It's truly something to see. About 400 dealers haul in their goods in long trailers and on the beds of pickup trucks. I go to the festival every year with my mom. These days, my parents are collecting less. In fact, as they downsize their life, my mom is looking to get rid of many of her antiques. But we enjoy browsing the aisles and eating barbecue sandwiches and looking at all the things that once belonged to other people. All things have their history, their provenance, and it's easy to get lost in their past. You can see it in those old cookbooks, or in a Brown Owl McCoy cookie jar, or in the milk glass lamp, or in the metal lunch buckets that still smell like wrapped peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. These are the relics of another lifetime, things that all once had a home someplace else. I can imagine their settings. I can imagine the story of their place. An old typewriter tells of a smoky office, of carbon-copied letters pounded out on letterpress stationery, the fast zoopt the roller makes when the paper is removed. Vintage mason jars tell of hot days spent canning, of blanching tomatoes and peaches in boiling water before putting them up, of sealing jars of beans and okra and setting them on a back porch, readying for a hard winter ahead. I can imagine the stories held within a tray of antique wedding rings, platinum bands with engravings still visible, full of so much promise and anticipation. All things that were once part of a future, now part of the past. I like to think that we can find a new place for these old things, these things that have endured throughout one lifetime already. I like to think we can create our own stories for them, and let them become part of our history, too. Blessings of Peace. Born and raised in the heart of North Carolina's Quaker Belt, my grandmother, whose maiden name was Allen, could trace her religious roots way back to the earliest Quaker settlers in the area, and even beyond that, all the way to the Irish Quakers before they migrated to Pennsylvania. When I was small, she'd tell me stories about growing up as a young girl in the early 1900s in her church in Ramseur, Holly Spring Friends Meeting House. After she married and moved to Ashboro, she continued to attend Holly Spring, but in her later years, and after my grandfather died, driving too far on the back roads of Randolph County to get there just wasn't an option. She found her place of worship closer to home, at Ashboro Friends Meeting. When I was about 9 years old, I started going to church with her. I looked forward to every Sunday, to putting on a dress and carrying my white Bible, the one engraved with my initials, my first gift from her when I was born. My parents, who had to open their shop on Sunday morning in Randolph Mall, would drop me off at her house, and she'd drive us the short 4 blocks to the church. When we parked, I'd come around to the driver's side of the car and help her out. Although she was still capable of driving, she had become unsteady on her feet, and it reassured her to be able to hold on to me. Quaker churches, if you've never been to one, are small on ceremony. There aren't any stained glass windows or any elaborate ornamentation. The music is modest. To my grandmother, this was important. She lived her life plainly, finding peace in the simplest of places, among the rose bushes in her backyard, or in her small kitchen, quietly assembling ingredients for one of her golden pound cakes. Ashboro Friends Meeting had a pastor, and we listened to the short sermon each Sunday. Afterward, I remember there was a time set aside for anyone in the church to stand and speak. "If the Spirit calls you," the old-timers would say. Often, nobody would speak, and we'd just sit quietly for what was called silent worship. My grandmother would drop her head and say silent prayers. She'd talk, I think, to my grandfather, and she'd pray for the health of her family, for my mom and dad, for me. Sometimes, during this silent worship, she'd slip me a piece of candy, usually an unwrapped buttermint. There was no noisy wrapper to deal with, and as she'd transfer the candy into my hand, I'd carefully pop it in my mouth without anyone seeing. Happy, and convinced that the two of us shared a secret that no one else knew about. Although my grandmother loved the services at Ashboro Friends, her heart never left Holly Spring, and that's where she was buried 15 years ago, alongside my grandfather, who died 10 years before she did. I hadn't been to Holly Spring since her funeral. A few days ago, I drove down there. I pulled into the small gravel driveway leading to the cemetery, and I got out of the car and walked around. It was unbelievably quiet. I saw the Hudson tombstone with her name, Norva Allen, and my grandfather's, Charles Ace, carved side by side. I saw the other markers for the Allen family, my family, small and worn, with dates from the 1800s still barely visible. And there were other stones, too, names I've known all my life, Henshaw and Stout, Craven and Cox. I've always thought church cemeteries were beautiful places. There's a reverence among these grounds that doesn't exist anywhere else, and at Holly Spring, maybe because it carries such a deep history, maybe because I felt so connected to my roots, I was overcome with emotion. I wish I'd had a piece of candy just then, something to pop in my mouth, something to ease the lump in my throat. I got back in the car and drove home, grateful for the family and friends that have shaped my life, and most of all, thankful in my heart for these profound places of peace. Window Shopping. Years before there was a mall on the highway, and before the big box stores cropped up on Dixie Drive, everyone in Ashboro went downtown to do their Christmas shopping. My grandmother lived a few blocks from downtown, and a few days before Christmas we'd walk to Sunset Avenue to see all the window displays. The window at Belk Yates was my favorite. Every year the store created a magical Christmas scene. Mechanical elves hammered out toys in a never-ending rhythm. Styrofoam snowflakes dangled from fishing line, and soft-eyed reindeer tilted their heads up and down. But the best part was all the lights. Dozens of strands of Christmas lights, each one its own tiny twinkling star, wound around the window, framing the whole display in brightness and warmth. Those lights spilled out beyond the window, illuminating the entire sidewalk and I could see, in the window's reflection, how my grandmother and I glowed. I loved it all so much. Everything about this scene was exactly how I'd imagined the North Pole, and I stood transfixed in front of this window for as long as my grandmother would let me, tingling with excitement. After Belk Yeats, we'd head to Eagles Five and Dime, where we'd take a break from the chilly air and go inside. Eagles was a store unlike any I'd ever been in. It didn't sell just one thing, like clothing or jewelry. It had everything anyone could ever want. It had clothing and small kitchen appliances, such as blenders and fondue pots. It had gardening items and beauty supplies, such as Jean Nate body spray and Coty face powder. It also had the best toy department in town. Stuffed animals and board games crowded the shelves that stretched nearly to the ceiling. Sleds and wagons hung overhead, suspended by chains from the metal beams, leaving valuable floor space for other things, like big wheels and toy kitchens. I'd wander the aisles of the toy department, searching the shelves for things I wanted, things I hoped would find their way under the Christmas tree at home. The Operation game, an Etch-a-Sketch, a Mrs. Beasley doll, a Woolly Willy magnetic game. On our way out of the store, we'd pass by my other favorite section, the long glass candy counter, behind which were dozens of bins of bulk candy. There were Bit of Honeys and Necco wafers and orange jelly slices. There were malted milk balls and lemon drops coated with sugar. My grandmother would hand me a dollar bill, and I'd get a small paper bag of my favorite candy on earth, Brock's Chocolate Stars. These were dollops of creamy milk chocolate in a star shape, and they were, without a doubt, the best candy that had ever been created. After Eagles, we'd keep walking, past Eva Fry's clothing store, where we'd admire the lean, graceful mannequins in heavy fur coats, past Grimes Jewelers, where we'd peer in at the watches on display, at the sparkling diamond rings that sat in their tiny boxes. My grandmother would make up stories about the ladies who might get those diamond rings on Christmas Eve. She'd tell me how the men might propose and where they'd spend their honeymoons. We giggled at our stories and walked arm in arm down the street, my grandmother and I, marching in our own little Christmas parade. We'd walk back home, eating our candy right out of the bag and letting the twinkling lights fade behind us. Eagles is, of course, long gone now, and Belk Yeats relocated to the Randolph Mall out on the highway nearly 30 years ago. It's an open storefront, and there's no window for mechanical displays. These days, there are so many more shopping choices, so many places to go. But whenever I drive down Sunset Avenue, I see the same buildings that used to house these stores, and I remember what it was like to stand in front of all those windows, in the glow of a childhood made so happy with lights and toys and a small bag of candy shaped like stars. The Morning Meal. It was early in the morning, still dark outside, and I came down the stairs at the Castle Bed and Breakfast at Silver Lake in Ocracoke a few hours before breakfast, a few hours still before most of the guests had gotten up. I thought I might find a cup and some hot water for tea in the inn's kitchen. I figured it was too early to hope for coffee, but when I walked into the room, I was surprised to find another woman, Gladys Stover, already there, standing behind the counter in front of the sink. She was adjusting an apron over her clothes. "Good morning," she said as I walked in, with the warmest lilt you've ever heard in someone's voice, greeting me with a genuine smile and the first words I heard that day. Gladys was working. She's one of the regular breakfast cooks at the castle, and it was easy to see how quickly she became immersed in the rhythm of the morning. She'd already made a pot of coffee for early risers like me and assembled the ingredients for biscuits. She was about to start mixing batter for French toast. And as I stood there for a few minutes, warming my hands on a coffee mug, watching her pull crates of eggs out of the refrigerator and turn on burners on the stove, I realized I'd found the inspiration for our first breakfast issue, something we had not done before in Our State magazine. I loved watching Gladys work in her kitchen, and I wanted readers to see what I saw, a hard worker, an early riser, someone who takes a great deal of pride in what she puts out there for other people to enjoy. For people in North Carolina, breakfast has always been a special meal. Our strong agricultural roots meant farmers who got up before sunrise, workers who depended on a hearty meal to carry them through the morning, fresh eggs, thick bacon, pancakes and grits and country potatoes and homemade strawberry preserved canned in the summer and opened at the table in the winter, the jar bursting with the memory of a brighter season, and a reminder that, in the midst of a cold winter, bountiful days will return. We feel a connection to our breakfast foods, certainly. Sausage from our pigs, eggs from our chickens, ingredients grown right beneath our feet on our own land. But more important, we feel a kinship to those people who take time to prepare our meals. Seeing Gladys in the kitchen in Ocracoke, spending her morning cooking for grateful guests, reminded me why breakfast holds such significance to us, why we think of it as the most personal meal of the day. It's the person behind the breakfast that makes it matter. For me, the best breakfast was the eggs that my grandmother scrambled in bacon drippings, cooked on those mornings after I'd spent the night with her, keeping her from loneliness the year my grandfather died. It was the waffles and sausage at the Golden Waffle after sunset, a much-anticipated breakfast for dinner treat whenever my Uncle Garland, long gone now, visited from Ramsur. It was the country ham biscuit from the drive-through of the Biscuit Company on the winter mornings when snow canceled school, but my parents had to keep their shop open anyway. I was too young to stay home by myself, so the three of us, my mom, dad, and I, piled into my dad's pickup truck and braved the slick roads, stopping on the way at the Biscuit Company for something good, something filling, something comforting, something warm. These are the breakfasts that carry us through our days, the breakfasts that carry us, really, through our lives. These are what give us our good mornings. Who we are. The Randolph Room at the Ashboro Public Library is crammed with all the materials anyone would need for historical or genealogical research. File cabinets and bookcases are filled with marriage records and old land deeds, newspapers and church records, library scrapbooks, Ellis Island emigration books, and Sanborn fire insurance maps. There are high school yearbooks from the county's schools. There are thick, leather-bound books stuffed with cemetery and census records. And then there's the shelf full of old city directories. Until I saw them sitting there, on my recent visit to the library, I'd forgotten all about these books and how much time I spent reading them when I was a kid. My grandfather, who was a life insurance salesman, ordered an updated directory every year, and when it came, I'd sneak away with it and spend hours poring over the pages, reading each entry the way some kids read dictionaries or world atlases. The city directory was just like a phone book, but better. Aside from names, addresses, and phone numbers, it listed what someone did for a living and where he worked, his wife's name and job if she was employed, how many people lived in the house, whether someone was retired. They were like condensed personal histories of everyone in town, and I guess it helped my grandfather in his business to know a little something about the people he called on. The directory told the story of the people who had lived in the town, the supervisor at Kloppman Mills who owned a home on Redding Road, the sawmill worker in Central Falls, the brick mason in Franklinville, the pastor at Seagrove United Methodist Church. Job descriptions were abbreviated, and I liked figuring out what MGR or Loom CLNR meant. There were listings for a WTRS at C. King Fish Camp, for a detective at Randolph County Sheriff's Department, for an assembler at GE, and for a maint man at Union Carbide, a weigher at Yates Country Ham, a stockroom employee at Stedman Furniture, a switchboard operator at First National Bank. I can't imagine why, at 7 years old, any of this was interesting to me, but I loved it. I loved knowing about people, even people I'd never know. I still do. When I read through these directories now, Ashborough's collection goes back to 1937, I see more than a listing of names. I see a portrait of a place. So many local business names emerge. Acme McCrary, Glen Raven Mills, B.B. Walker Shoe Company, that it's easy to pinpoint Ashborough's identity. A hard-working town, blue-collar built. A family place. A compact community. I can almost see, too, what these listings didn't say, that the maintenance man at Union Carbide was also a World War II United States Army veteran, that the waitress at Sea King Fish Camp just finished her associate's degree at what was then Randolph Tech, that the farmer, whose address was listed simply as Route 4, lost his wife. Of course, I don't know these details for sure, but because of the descriptions, I could think of these people as more than names in a phone book. They held jobs, and had families, and owned homes. When you know what people do, you can understand the story of who they are. And they stop being faceless names on a page, or anonymous entries in a book. They become real. They become people we know. Southern Storms. My grandmother always knew when a storm was coming. If we had the windows open in the house, or if we were out in the yard digging in her garden, she would smell it first. "It's going to come up a cloud," she'd say, lifting her chin toward the sky. And she was always right. Back then, there was no weather channel with 24-hour satellite imagery, of course, so people like my grandmother relied on their own senses to tell them whenever a shift was happening in the atmosphere. I never questioned her accuracy. She knew exactly how long we had to get the laundry off the line before the rain came. She knew how to count between rumbles of thunder and streaks of lightning to tell how far away a storm was. Sometimes I think it's a skill we've lost. Right before one of these summertime storms, my grandmother would hurry to get to the porch so she could sit and watch it roll in. Not me. I hated storms, especially the fierce ones that popped up in the summer. Deep growls of thunder shook the old windows in her house and terrified me. I kept my eyes closed when the lightning tore at the sky. Whenever we had one of these storms, I hid on my grandmother's bed with my head buried in her pillow, while she sat on the front porch, rocking. She loved it. It was as though there was just something in her, drawing her to this porch, to the outdoors, while thunder erupted all around, and rain slid off the roof in sheets. It was as if she had a front-row seat to a full-scale musical, and she wanted to stay for the whole show. My grandmother was like that. She got enjoyment out of everything. For her, life, its sunny days and its stormy ones, too, was worth the price of admission. Occasionally, when I was feeling brave, I'd inch out from the bedroom and make my way to the screen door where I could watch her. I can see her there as clear as if it were yesterday, dressed in one of her polyester pantsuits, her lean legs crossed. My grandmother was both country and elegant. She knew how to pat out a pan of the best biscuits you've ever had in your life. She knew how to avoid chiggers when she was picking blackberries. And she knew how to drape a strand of pearls around her slender neck and look like the most beautiful woman in the world. I wanted to sit out there with her, but I just couldn't bring myself to do it. Through the metal grates of the screen door, I'd ask in a tiny voice, "Don't you want to come back in, Grandma?" And she would, because she knew I was scared. She knew how to comfort me, too, her only granddaughter. That was another thing it seemed like she was born knowing how to do. I miss her so much. I wish I could sit with her now and watch for one of those late summer storms. But instead, I can lift my chin to the sky and listen for the thunder and wait for the rain. When it comes, it'll smell so good. January snow. On January 25th, 2000, about 13 inches of snow fell at my home in Greensboro. Raleigh got a foot and a half. It beat the record for 17.8 inches set in 1927. Siler City got 22 inches, and in some areas of the state, more than 2 feet fell. The Federal Emergency Management Agency called it the most powerful winter storm to hit North Carolina in 72 years. The forecast the night before predicted a dusting to less than an inch. This storm caught everyone by surprise. My dad, at home in Randolph County, woke up at 3 a.m. Because of the brightness reflecting into the house, he thought it was morning. He got up and went into the kitchen for coffee. But the coffee maker hadn't brewed. He noticed it was cold in the house. He noticed that it was unusually quiet. Cars that normally whizzed down old Highway 49 were absent. And then he looked outside. My parents' den is sunken, and the windows look out at ground level. The snow rose halfway up the windows and stood shin high in front of the doors. For a moment, my dad, trapped in a house buried in so much snow, by Randolph County standards anyway, he could barely push the back door open, thought surely this was the end of the world. He'd never seen anything like it. The weight of the snow pulled down power lines and trees. More than 250,000 people in North Carolina lost power for a week. Towns shut down. Power crews worked around the clock. My parents lit candles and boiled coffee on top of their kerosene heater, and they did the only thing they could do. They waited for the sun. They waited for the sun to come out and make it all go away. And yet, at night, despite the cold and the lack of power and the crack of branches breaking through the silence, when the moon cast its glimmer across my parents' front yard, it was hard not to be transfixed by the beauty of what was on the ground. That's the thing about snow. It dulls most of the senses. It muffles sound, mutes smell. It's numbing to touch. It masks the landscape with whiteness, rendering everything colorless. In artist terms, white is the absence of color. But in reality, it's just the opposite. It's the culmination of all colors, the swirling together of everything in the light spectrum. Some people look at snow and see all of its pitfalls, its potential for destruction, its hazards and dangers, its ability to bring small towns to their knees. Some people look at snow and see all its beauty and how it covers all the imperfections in a landscape. Careful observers see both sides. Nature carries with it the power for calamity and the opportunity for calm. It's the culmination, the swirling together of everything, the wild and the tame, the light and the dark, that makes it all so beautiful. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Triangle Yesteryear is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening.
I think we can hear what I say. Nothing could be finer than to be in Carolina in the morning.